This is from the Babylonian Talmud. The phrase says in Hebrew, "Akam le'orgecha, hashkem le'orgo." Whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first.
Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
What drives the State of Israel's instinct for survival? How do those instincts express themselves? Are threats against Israel more existential than faced by other nations? This episode, perhaps more than any other in the series so far, examines the psyche of the Jewish state. What happened when a stateless people, victims of genocide, learnt they needed to kill in order to survive?
Meir Dagan, one of the legendary Mossad chiefs, hanged on the wall of his offices, I would say, since he was a lieutenant commander, he had a black and white photograph which he took with him everywhere. And in that photograph, you can easily see and understand the scene where a Jewish Haredi man is kneeling, his hands in the air, with his eyes gleaming with terror, and the Gestapo officers pointing their gun at him. And he says to everybody coming to his office, "You see this guy in the picture? This is my grandfather, Dov Ehrlich, in the ghetto of Lokow in Poland in 1942, just seconds before those bastards from Gestapo shot him to death." And he says, "We are here, I am here as chief of Mossad, and the Mossad, the gatekeepers, the custodians on the wall, we are here to make sure that two things will never happen again. Jews will not kneel, there will not be a second Holocaust." Now, this mindset is inherent to everyone serving in the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and the intelligence community, that it's up to them.
Our guest is Ronen Bergman, author of the best-selling book, Rise and Kill First. It's a title which required a lot of ruminating over. And then again, so did writing, editing, and publishing the book itself. Ronen thought it would take about a year, and in the end it took six, and then a further couple of years to edit and publish. Through interviewing 1,000 different people, the phrase, "rise and kill first," from the Babylonian Talmud, kept on coming up in conversation. A phrase seemingly inscribed in the mindset, even hearts, of many of Israel's defensive operators, underpinned by generational Jewish persecution. No other security service thinks quite like this. "Rise and kill first" is an account of targeted assassinations. Since World War II, Israel has assassinated more people than any other country in the Western world. That's a frank sentence from the start of the book. "Rise and Kill First" reveals the foundational thinking of Israel's security services and how they were forged in the Jewish struggle for self-determination. But for all the sudden, brutal decisions, this account remains a very humane one, and mistakes are made too. The book's detail comes from a wealth of unclassified documents, 1,000 interviewees, some quizzed multiple times by Ronen, plus documents, forgotten, which happened to be in the private possession of veterans who gave him them. They would have had their varying reasons to do that, to relay their preferred version of events, to shape history to suit themselves, perhaps. And that required additional sourcing in order to scotch such revisionist attempts. None of the accounts are endorsed or verified by the Israeli Defense Establishment, which makes the reading still more fascinating. "Rise and Kill First" is a New York Times bestseller. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. We call them suicide bombers in the West. Islamists don't. And we discuss the bombers, their psychometrics and social backgrounds, with surprising findings. Ronen tells me why commanders of these bombings don't do the job themselves if one of their proposed bombers dropped out. And yes, since the book, Mohsin Fakhrizadeh was killed by remote control robot in Iran, according to Ronen Bergman.
Remember the name, Fakhrizadeh, when they took all the CDs out of Iran.
This is how Dr. Mohsin Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh. This work is carried out by Sapan. That's an organization inside Iran's defense ministry. And you will not be surprised to hear that Sapan is led by the same person who led Project Ahmad, Dr. Fakhrizadeh.
Iran has been quick to point the finger at America and Israel, suggesting that the countries want to inflame tensions before Donald Trump leaves the White House.
And apparently a remote control machine gun killed Fakhrizadeh, but none of the security guards around him as he was going home on a Friday afternoon to his holiday home somewhere outside Tehran. True or false?
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard published the story, made that public only after giving completely other versions that there is a firefight defending of the security details defending Fakhrizadeh, that some of the perpetrators, the assassins, were killed, some of them were caught, some of them are in interrogation cells of the Revolutionary Guard, and you can just imagine, you know, what that means. Some of them were completely some of them are talking, cooperating, and all of that after, of course, admitting that Fakhrizadeh, their main client, the one that they protected, was killed. After that, they came with the story that it was a robot. Not just a robot, but a robot that is commanded from Tel Aviv through satellite with biometric systems. And the whole of the Iranian blogosphere went just nuts, mocking the Revolutionary Guard, because it was, you know, walking, I don't know if it works in English, in Hebrew they say they walk with butter on their heads in
yeah,
the sun.
That works.
So they said, well, they failed, so now they come up with this nonsense story about the robot, like a force majeure. What can you do against the robot? Not just a robot from a satellite. But in that case, and you know, they're not very famous, the Revolutionary Guard, with telling the truth. They said I am a Mossad assassin or Mossad intelligence officer, and Yana, my wife, says that this is just an ample proof of how poor the Iranian intelligence is, because if they knew me, they would know that I have no navigation skills, I don't know how to drive, I don't know how to manage myself, and my orientation in space is very limited. The last thing Mossad would want is me as part of their crew. It would just, you know, assassination in Tehran would just go nowhere. But in that specific case, they had it spot on. It was a robot. It was a robot because Mossad decided to use that because any other possibility, any other scenario, any other MO turned out to end with probable fire exchange between the security details, between 4 and 7 cars full with security guards, and a lot of weapon, and the operatives. And, you know, something that you cannot predict how will end. And of course, all the military and the police coming through the firefight. So a strong chance that some of the perpetrators, some of the assassins are not going to get off their life. Now, if there is a one ironclad rule to all Mossad operations on enemy territory, is that you attribute the same kind of importance to the success of the mission, but also to the evacuation safely of all the agents. And once they realized this is not possible, the whole plan got stuck. Until someone came with the idea of a robot. Wow. And one day we will tell the story of that someone. But robot, of course, completely puts away the main problem of live people. But it creates many other problems. You know, the robot with all the, you know, the machine gun, the cameras, yes, the equipment to the communication equipment to the satellite, the AI, the computers, the the reserve computers and the explosive, all of them weighs 1 ton. It needs to be completely disassembled, smuggled into, like, in tiny pieces into Iran, then reassembled, then recalibrate, recapture with the satellite, then put on a Zamiat, that's a local brand of Nissan, like a pickup, and then have enough intelligence to know when Fakhrizadeh and his convoys, his wife, are leaving his dacha by the Caspian Sea, going to where they're going to spend the weekend, as you mentioned, put the Zamiat in the right place after the last turn, and another hidden camera before that, in a U-turn, so there's a final identification that it's indeed Fakhrizadeh sitting behind the wheel. And then the actual use of that. Now, the use of the robot sounds easy. So you have, you know, like in the movie, you have like the Jackal. The movie The Jackal has something like that. But in the movie, the Jackal is sitting, you know, like say a kilometer away from the scene. Still away, but a kilometer away. Here, the signal going from the camera attached to the robot, to the machine gun, going up to the satellite and down to Tel Aviv will take 0.8 seconds. Then, right, the sniper will take around between half and three quarters of a second, and then the signal will still need another 0.8 to go back. So, altogether, something like 2.5 to 3 seconds gap. During which the car, of course, progress. So you need AI system to compensate for the gap. And it's, you know, it's just imagine how hard that is. And it took something like 3 bursts of fire to the sniper to fulfill the mission. Now, of course, there's a whole controversy surrounding the question of, is it a legal, moral, justified target to kill a person who did not kill anyone in his hand in his life? Of course,
it's just for his knowledge.
Because of his, not just his knowledge, but because of him being the chief of the weapon group trying to manufacture a nuclear bomb from Iran. But I'm leaving those moral and ethical and legal questions aside. At the end of the day, it was only Fakhrizadeh, not his wife, and not his bodyguards, that were not scratched. He was the only one killed. And, you know, I will leave that as an open question. Was that effective? Was that legal? Was that moral? Did that make the world a better place?
Ronen Bergman, welcome to Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you, Johnny. My honor.
It's my pleasure to have you, and congratulations on a best-selling, fascinating read because of its sheer detail. It reads like a thriller, but every line is factual.
Yes, and thank you. And the factual part was, of course, the hardest. I always say, people tell me, flatter me that I know how to write and speak and tell a narrative as if it's a thriller. And I say that you need to be an idiot not to tell those great stories in a good way, because they're just great stories. But to make sure that I'm reaching the optimum level of accuracy, corroborating information from shadow world of sometimes shadowy people, and in any case, people that are not easy to convince to be interviewed. This was a long, long journey.
And as a journalist, an investigative journalist here, there are certain moments where the story cannot be corroborated. There's no second source for some of the things that you are told. How do you deal with that?
So, no, look, most of the stories I'm telling do not end or do not happen in a narrative where the crucial parts are happening as a duel. It's not only Carla versus George Smiley. it's you know, they were Carla and Joe Smiley, of course, but there was the whole Second Directorate and MI6 behind them or around them, and those two declined to comment. Then you'll have a lot of other people, and I would say that the difficulty sometimes is to have too many witnesses. You know, one of the former Mossad chief told me, you know, he said, well, I don't understand. You take all those people and get their testimonies about something that happened 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I have operatives coming back from the operation reporting to me 2 days after and having different versions. Now, they are not lying. But it's like, you know, it's like Rashomon of Akira Kurosawa. People have different angles of and perspective and perception and views and angles and position. So they tell a little bit of different story. So when I had only one source that tells a story, then I flashed it out in the footnotes. They made sure that it's clear that it's only him, or that there are contradictions, because sometimes there are. There is, you know, there's an ongoing debate between historians per the evaluation of oral sources. I was fortunate to write the history of an organization or intelligence community, the Israeli intelligence community, that did not declassify any of its documents. Those are just not out there. Not just basing the book on oral sources, and the book is based on 1,000 interviewees. Some of them I had to interview a few times. But also, if someone looks at the footnotes, she or he will be able to see this massive use of documents. And those documents, which I was fortunate to use, were forgotten in the private possession of veterans before they left, and were given to me by them. And so that the 100,000 interviews, the existing published reports, the not published before thousands of documents, I think gives an ability to get as close as possible to the truth. Some of them I had to interview a few times, so in terms of actual meetings, the number is much higher.
Thousands of interview sessions, mm-hmm. tens of thousands of pages, maybe even more.
Mm-hmm. Millions of words of transcripts.
A book that you hoped would take a year, it took you six.
It took six to write, research, and then two more years to edit. So 8 years. We started. The initial conversation with Random House took place in April 2010. The book was published on January 27, 2018.
Let's go with the title now, because you had years to think about it, and you've come up with a wonderful title, Rise and Kill First. Why that title? Where does it come from?
So the first idea was almost the obvious, to call it License to Kill. But then we searched Amazon, and it turns out that there are 64 other books that are using License to Kill as a title, or part of the title. So
it's a bit of a James Bond thing as well, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and so we decided that's not going to work. Then there was another idea, my idea, awful idea, to call that The Art of Assassinations, like The Art of War of Sun Tzu, which sounds like a coaching Zen book which nobody would read. So that was this was taken off. And then one person who was privy to actually read the millions of words and the thousands of transcripts, he said, you know, Ronnie, there's one sentence that many of your different interviewees keep on quoting. And this is from the Babylonian Talmud. The phrase says, whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. In Hebrew, akam leogecha, Hashkem Leorgo, whoever comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. And this, when suggested, suddenly everybody around, you know, people who handled the book, everybody supported that, in spite of the fact that for Israelis, when you say this phrase in Hebrew to Israelis, everybody would understand. And I'll get to the meaning in a minute. But for foreigners, it's not. It doesn't say anything, but it catches. And we, because the sentence itself is too long, we just kept the second part, rise and kill first. Which, those different interviews, they quoted that not in order to impress me or the readers with their knowledge of the Talmud, but because they wanted to convey, I think, their mindset when participating, ordering, planning, executing those highly risk operation way beyond enemy lines. Some of them very controversial, taking the most aggressive means, but all of them were done with this sentence in the background, which basically says that if you under threat of being killed, if your country is under threat of being extinct, then you rise up and kill first. Now, this mindset is different than I think any mindset of any almost any intelligence service and any defense forces. Now, of course, defense forces are there to defend, of course, but when the memory of the past correlates with the present nemesis, the present enemies, challenging the existence of the state, or at least seen by the Jews in Israel as threatening a second annihilation, then you are left with one choice. Rise and kill first.
A very Jewish perspective on self-defense. And the first line sets out the tone, a blunt statement. Since World War II, Israel has assassinated more people than any other country in the Western world, which sums up the mentality that you're talking about. The Mossad had to come from somewhere. So you go into the origins of those agencies in various Zionist militias and early forms of the IDF. As you put it, guerrillas, assassins, terrorists were at the heart of the new Jewish state's army and intelligence community.
Yeah. It's a combination. You know, Meir Dagan, one of the legendary Mossad chief who died of cancer in 2016 and led the organization during most of the previous decade, hanged on the wall of his offices, I would say, since he was a lieutenant commander in the tent, he had a black and white photograph which he took with him everywhere. Ended up at the wall of the Mossad chief in Mossad headquarters north to Tel Aviv. And in that photograph, you can easily see and understand the scene where a Jewish Haredi man is kneeling on his standing on his knees with his hands in the air, with his eyes gleaming with terror, and Gestapo officers pointing their gun at him. And he says to everybody coming to his office, his people, but also counterparts from other intelligence organizations. I heard the story from, not just from him, and not just from people in Mossad, but also from people who came to see him, chiefs of the CIA and the NSA. He said, you see this guy in the picture? This is my grandfather. Dov Ehrlich in the ghetto of Lokov in Poland in 1942, just seconds before those bastards from Gestapo shoot him to death. And he says, we are here, I am here as chief of Mossad, and the Mossad, the gatekeepers, the custodians on the wall, we are here to make sure that two things will never happen again. Jews will not kneel. There will not be a second Holocaust. Now, this mindset is inherent to everyone serving in the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, and the intelligence community, that it's up to them to secure the sole existence of the state of the Jews. And that changes everything.
And indeed, Maya Dagan was born to Jewish refugees on an icy floor of a train heading from the Ukraine to Poland at the end of World War II. And indeed, one of their agents, Nehemiah Mary, cleverly survived the Einsatzgruppen killing squads at just 12 years old and climbed out of a blood-soaked pit of murdered people, many others. There's no other people that have this grounding in self-defense that has made Shin Bet and what the Mossad is today.
Yeah, I have a friend, very famous international renowned journalist, says, you know, Ronan, and he covers intelligence services and national security, and it's his country. He said, you know, sometimes I'm jealous because in your country the shit really happens. Because those intelligence services and military and defense forces were created during war and carved and established under fire. And they were being tested and in war situation since day one. Now, the IDF has quiet years, or of course years that it does not need to engage in all-out war. But the intelligence services are in all-out war all the time, because it's up to them to do basically two main things. One is to bring the necessary information from the enemy country or organization. And second, which is very unique to Israeli intelligence services, is not just to bring the information. If you go CIA.gov and see what are the main targets of the CIA, the American Central Intelligence Agency, you'll see that the main goal is to bring information that would help the decision-making process of the leaders of the United States, which is quite a heavy one by itself. But for Israeli intelligence, where this is only the beginning, a success, what will be seen as a great success by the CIA is only the beginning of the second task of Israeli intelligence, which is to engage and prevent enemy plans against Israel. So to take the information, the intelligence collected from enemy territory and translate that into operation, sabotage, cyber, bombing, explosions, and at the peak of that, targeted killings.
The best guests and their most heartfelt views, a relay of their missions to a worldwide audience. 100 episodes along, and I'm proud that it's fast become the podcast of record. This is coverage of the Jewish and Israeli world that just doesn't get properly aired in mass media, and I'm not ashamed to ask for your help. A one-off donation is always gratefully received to support my efforts, but a monthly donation really gets our service off the ground. Your donation can also be made with gift aid, and it's so easy to do. Just click on this, donorbox.org/JG podcast. That's donorbox.org/JG podcast. Are you in? Please share my series with your friends, and thank you for listening.
But Ronan, there is some very ugly reading in the book, even for the most ardent Israel supporter. Innocents, even children, are killed in the pursuit of killing a terrorist. The purpose of Mossad is to stop the wider killing of citizens, but unfortunately, tragically, innocent people do die in these missions.
Yeah. So first, just not to put too much responsibility just on the shoulders of Mossad, the book is about Mossad and the rest
and
of the Israeli
yeah.
Intelligence community and IDF, and the cooperation between, tight cooperation between the Shin Bet, so the Israeli equivalent to MI5, and the military, gave birth to the most, I would say, massive, extensive machine of targeted killing ever created, and was launched or operated in the second intifada, the one that broke out in September of 2000 and lasted for 4 years, and I would say could be characterized better as the suicide bomber intifada, because though in number the suicide bombers were just a fraction of the number of violent operations or violent actions that took place, but they took severely heavy toll in casualties and injured people from Israeli citizens. Only in March of 2002, some 150 civilians got killed from suicide bombers in 1 month. It turned out to be the smart bomb of the poor people, of the poor organization. You recruit someone, you need to indoctrinate that someone, but once you did, he doesn't need any exercise, no training, and the only thing he needs to do is to take the suicide belt, cross the line into Israel, abort a bus, enter a shopping mall or a kindergarten, and switch the knob from off to on, exploding himself and all the people around him. Now, of course, thinking about that minute when someone turns that knob from off to on, that's inconceivable. You don't understand the mindset that leading people, but facts remain, it happened, and Hamas boasted.
Even British Muslims went over there.
They tried, you know, I was present in when that started, the, would say, the export of suicide bombers from Iran to Lebanon, from Lebanon into Israel and the territories. I was present when teams of psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists that were working with the Shin Bet were dispatched to interview suicide bombers that did not succeed, or the recruiters of suicide bombers in Israeli prisons. And they tried to create the profile of a typical average suicide bomber, so they could, you know, like Minority Report, try to understand who could be recruited and maybe stop it before. The result were that the average suicide bomber is a male, between 20 and 25, who has very basic education, if at all, sometimes complete analphabet, and did not left his village or city for most of, if not all. Very easy, he's single, he doesn't have a family, and he's easy to manipulate, easy to indoctrinate. Someone a little bit dumb, they call it, say in Arabic, Mraffal is sort of an idiot, that can be easily maneuvered. Now, that seems, you know, possible. But then it turns out that the suicide bombers worldwide do not work and do not come from the corridors of society as the psychological profile that the Shin Bet created for them. Suddenly it turns out that some of them are married, some of them are older or younger, some of them, you know, that 16 of the 19 perpetrators of 9/11 had at least high school education, if not more than that. So, and some of them were women, of course. Some of, like, suicide bombers in the territories were women. So it doesn't work. Profiling them just didn't work. But when we interviewed, this was 1998, when we interviewed one of the main perpetrators of suicide bombers, a person who sent 3 suicide bombers to kill Israeli soldiers in January of 1995. And I asked him, because the third suicide bomber decided he's not going. He gave back the bomb to the guy that recruited him and said, maybe I'll become a shaheed, but not today. Ma'asalam. And this guy shouted at him, you are Jesus, Muawin, so you are a spy of the Israeli. It didn't help. He gave him the bomb and went away. So when I met with this guy, the commander of the cell, I said, why didn't you go? Meaning, you know that your plan is not going to be executed as you wanted. You have two suicide bombers, three bombs. Why didn't you go with the third one? Making sure that the first two do as you asked them. And he says, I don't understand the question. Everyone has his job. There are those who needs to perform istishhad, which is to become a shaheed.
Yes.
Because in their perception, this is not committing suicide. We call it suicide bombers, but they are not committing a suicide. Committing a suicide in Islam is forbidden, like in Judaism. This is not committing a suicide. This is becoming a shaheed, because the land of Israel is all supposed to be Muslim, and every Israeli, including women and children, are soldiers in the enemy's army. So he said that there are those whose job is to become shaheed, and there are those like me whose job is to recruit them and send them over. Now I thought to myself, well, what's this thing with everyone's job? And I realized he's afraid.
Yeah.
He was just afraid. And that was the solution. And I'm going back to your question. The killings of bystander, the killings of the collateral damage,
yes,
is horrible. Cannot be, should not be justified. Everyone who is using the lethal weapon called targeted killing needs to know that he has accountability for killing civilians. But we also need to bear in mind that those perpetrators were using civilian neighborhoods, not just
as cover.
They were using their own family, you know. Some of those most wanted Hamas leaders, their marriage life became the best possible since they became most wanted, because they didn't leave their wives for 1 minute. And I don't want to be that commander of the war room in Shin Bet. It needs to make a call. There's a window of opportunity to kill the commander, the military commander of Hamas, who already was involved or ordered the killing of 430 Israelis. One of the main commanders of Hamas, codename Flag Bearer. And they tell him, there's a window of opportunity. We know where he is, and he's very evasive, but he's there with his wife.
Mm.
So killing him, using your window, will probably, most certainly, kill his wife. So, what do you do? And I'm not jealous in anyone needs to make such a call.
What happened?
So they decided to kill him. And they dropped one ton bomb on a building in Gaza. His wife was with him. There were some people in Shin Bet who warned that they believed that his daughter is with him. Some said she's not. She was killed. But much worse, it was not just Salah Shahada, that's the name of Flag Bearer, and his wife and his kid, but because of lack, I would say, negligence of collection of intelligence from the area, they didn't know that the shats just beside this building that was hit are all populated, and 50 more people were killed, including 8 children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was horrible.
Yeah.
Should not have been happening.
And as you say, on page 19, which relates to this sort of tragedy, as Israel would learn repeatedly in future years, it is very hard to predict how history will proceed after someone is shot in the head. So someone beyond the targeted killing creates the potential for an intifada. That targeted assassinations are very good short-term, but long-term they cause more misery, more heartache, more belligerence on the Palestinian side.
Well, let me... The sentence you just quoted refers to a quote from the person who commanded the assassination of Khalil al-Wazir, who was the deputy, the military deputy for military issues of Yasser Arafat. He was killed by the IDF and Mossad in Tunis in April 1988. Mm-hmm. And when I interviewed Moshe Bogi Yaelon, later to become, he was the commander of Sayeret Matkal, the high elite reconnaissance commander unit. He was then their commander, then he became the chief of staff and the minister of defense. And when I interviewed him, he was minister of defense, about that, he was talking about shooting Abu Jihad in the head, as he did. But the historical turns are not predicted, especially when you talk about leaders. When you kill leaders, you can expect that history would change. You just don't know where it will go.
Yeah.
You refer to the weight of hatred, bloodshed, destruction, ashes of war, which are piled and will or might lead to further revenge. Now, this is all true, but if the other side does not accept your existence and launch attack, then you might think this might be a good reaction. I don't, like, if we, just taking, you know, resorting to a luxury of an example from somewhere else, the U.S. has used the policy of targeted killing against Al-Qaeda in extensive pace, especially under President Barack Obama, leading, of course, to the assassination or the killing of Osama bin Laden. Now, the day when killing this mega terrorist or the other, or Osama bin Laden, did they think that this will increase the circle of blood? Did anyone? And I'm not talking about doing justice. It's not about doing justice. It's about the day after. Is this effective? Will make the world a better place? I would say that one of the main principles, Little Hart spoke about that in his time. If you win a war, it is on your responsibility to start a negotiation, to use the diplomatic path. And this is, I think, if there's a lesson from the book, one of the lessons is that indeed Israeli intelligence, I think, and you know, we're sitting here in London, so I'm not, no disrespect to the Her Majesty's intelligence services, which, by the way, you know, Mossad are not very, I would say, easy with compliments to others, especially that are not Mossad. But they always, always have the highest respect to MI6. Always. And you know, Mossad are very famous in their ability to recruit human agents. But they always say, if there's someone better than us, it's MI6.
That's great, because Israel is not afraid of acknowledging its shortcomings or failure, and so therefore by paying a compliment to another agency, learning from their own mistakes, and then moving on to achieve success by those moments.
And those successes can be, I would say, luring to the wrong conclusion. And this is what I was aiming at the end of the book, though I try not to give my views, you know, I'm distant. But if there's a conclusion there, I think Israeli intelligence was or is excellent. One of the best, if not the best, intelligence communities in the world that is able to come with the solution to any challenge posed to him by the leaders of Israel. But the leaders, and I'm not talking about a specific leader, in spite of your smile, the leaders throughout history took this to a wrong conclusion. They believe that at the tip of the fingers, there's some kind of an exotic capability to dismantle, if not to destroy, any threat. They order, the threat is dead. That's it. And they didn't realize that those challenges have, there's some limit upon which you cannot use force with. You need to resort to other ways, other channels of exchanging with the adversary. And when they thought that they can resort, they can solve everything with ordering Mossad to explode this place, or destroy that bunker or kill that nuclear scientist, they did not take the risk of using talks, of using diplomacy, of using policy. This, I think, is a story of the story of the book. The story described in the book is a story of unbelievable, a series of unbelievable, mind-blowing tactical successes and a threat to a devastating strategic failure.
The hallmarks of the people of Israel. I'm going to quote Genesis 32:28. Israel fights with God and man and yet prevails. I think that's a subtext to what your book is about.
I think that it prevails, it wins against all odds. You know, Amoach HaYehudi, Jewish man. And after prevailing, after winning, it needs to understand that it has a certain obligation and continue to build a new, as Shimon Peres says, a new Middle East with other means.
And while you're on, did you catch these episodes of Johnny Gould's Jewish State? Press the subscribe button. Scroll back for Danny, the Mossad commander, and the extraordinary story of the Red Sea spies.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that because this is something I think I never told anybody.
Danny, this is very, very beautiful, and this is really going to be an extraordinary interview.
And the inside story on the making of Fauda.
It's a special unit, very special unit, that actually Israel created in order to avoid mass casualties. You have to go inside a difficult and a crazy places in order to pick and to take just one terrorist instead of bombing a whole neighborhood or something like that. So you risk your life in order to do that. You have to be an amazing actor because you're going to be an undercover. And you have to go inside territories with different language, different body language, different clothes, different smell, everything. You have to be an amazing actor and a very cool guy because there is a lot of things that are happening around you and you have to avoid all the noises and just concentrate on the thing that you've been sent to do.
It's even more remarkable than something that Fauda could invent. And that is an example of... it's an impossible idea that Doron can become a Mizrahi or become an Arab or become a Sephardi or an Ashkenazi. It's impossible that he does all of those things because there's one little moment of Arab pronunciation that means that they know he's a spy.
Nowadays, you know, Rafi Eitan, the guy who captured Eichmann, told me that in the old times it was so easy to forge passports that sometimes they forge passports of countries that do not exist. Nowadays it's very impossible, hard to create an alliance, to create a legend, a false identity that would hold more than, let's say, an hour, or that would hold vis-a-vis some serious authority or enforcement agency that is really suspecting someone, is trying to look, is he for real? Very, very hard. And there are many, many different ways, agencies are looking for different ways to solve that. Some of them successfully, some of them not. One specific one possible, of course, possibility is drones or robots. Mm-hmm. But as we learn at the end of the day, and once more information would be published about what happened in Ukraine behind the scenes, we will see that at the end of the day, sometimes there is no replacement for human agent in the right place.
Wonderful.
And we end with that.
Ronen Bergman, Rise and Kill First, eminent author, great thinker on these matters. Thank you very much for joining me at Johnny Gould's Jewish State.
Thank you, Johnny. Thanks so much.
Never miss another Johnny Gould's Jewish State and be first to hear the next show by subscribing now.